Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. This episode lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of screenwriter Rod Serling. Quoting from the PBS American Masters episode about him, quote, "Known primarily for his role as creator and host of television's The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling had one of the most exceptional and varied careers in television. As a writer, a producer, and for many years a teacher, Serling challenged the medium of television to reach for loftier artistic goals. The winner of more Emmy Awards for dramatic writing than anyone in history, Serling expressed a deep social conscience in nearly everything he did." End quote. For this episode, we are joined by Emmy Award-winning screenwriter Joseph Doherty and communications professor William Ressler. You can learn more about them in the episode description. Joseph and William are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place December 13th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Joe and Bill, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm quite excited to talk about Rod Serling with you. As I mentioned, it's a personal favorite of mine. Grew up watching episodes of The Twilight Zone with my dad. And Joe, I've really enjoyed reading your book from the writer's perspective, Rod Serling at 100. But before we get into too much, could each of you just tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you've been up to recently? Joe, would you like to start?
Sure. Thanks for reading the book, and I'm quite proud of it. It's not a work of scholarship. It's a work of affection, I think, more than anything else. I've been very lucky to have a pretty long career writing television, going back a couple of decades now, and I've always credited my early exposure to Rod Serling as the kind of guiding light that set me on this track that I've been on. And 2024 is Serling's centenary. He would have been 100 this year. He died at the age of 50 in 1975, which was a tragedy unto itself. I've been moving out of television. I've been doing more playwriting. I've been having some success with that. And I'm just going to keep on writing because I think it's what Rod would have done if he'd still been here.
That's true, right? Not much for a writer to do other than write, right?
No, sir.
And Bill, how about yourself?
I teach at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. I am just wrapping up the, it's called an Ithaca College First Year Seminar. It's a required course all across the campus, interdisciplinary, many different topics. And the topic that I chose for the seminar that I teach to these first-year students is social responsibility in entertainment education, the legacy of The Twilight Zone and Rod Serling. And the reason is, among other reasons, Rod Serling used to teach here. He taught at Ithaca College, died in Ithaca, sadly, in 1975. He taught at Ithaca College from, I think, 1967 to 1975. It was also a period where all communication school students, regardless of their major, took a fourth-year, three-credit course called Social Responsibility in Communications. And it's always been, even though we don't always talk about it, we don't always have the formal course requirement, it's always been the mission of the Roy H. Park School of Communications at Ithaca College to inculcate that sense of, yes, be successful. Yes, you can create the Saw franchise. Yes, you can go off and be the president of Disney. But you also need to remember that it's a tremendous responsibility and that the entertainment content that you create has the potential to be the vehicle for some very important social messages. And that was, that was a lesson we learned from Rod Serling at a time when people weren't really thinking about that in television, at least, maybe in more highbrow entertainment media, but not in television. And he really did so much to get us there. I mean, I don't know if we would have had a Norman Lear or a Gene Roddenberry or, so many other people, Jordan Peele, who were influenced by Rod Serling's approach to this medium. So that's what I try to share with the students. And to my unbounded joy, the students really do pick up on that. And yes, many of them have said to me, oh, I remember watching The Twilight Zone with my father. And it really gave me an appreciation for those old media. So that's me, and that's what I've been doing.
That's great. And you know, sometimes in addition to president of Disney, you can graduate from the Park School and make podcasts for the American Writers Museum, like I did.
Yes, indeed. And be very good at it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And I really enjoyed my time there at Ithaca. Part of which I never explored it myself that much, but I know the Rod Serling archives are
yes.
housed there. Are you familiar with what's in that collection?
A little bit. It's up in the library and it's open. You should come back, come to campus. I'd love to take you up there and introduce you to our librarians who are carefully keeping those safe and opening them for all scholars and students who are interested. In fact, many of my colleagues and students as well have gone up there. There are quite a few people in the Park School of Communications who have been influenced by Rod Serling, including Nick Sagan, who wrote for Star Trek. He wrote for The Next Generation and Star Trek Voyager and literally drew inspiration from several episodes of The Twilight Zone, including The After Hours, which led to one of the best episodes of Star Trek Voyager that I've seen.
It's interesting that one of the things that you've just mentioned is I think Rod Serling represents the beginning of the showrunner.
Mm.
It's the first time there had been hosts before The Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. but it was the first time that a writer stood in one and said, these are handcrafted objects. He always mentioned the other writers when he introduced episodes. I think the concept of one guiding creative mind behind a television show, mm-hmm. you have to track it to him. Mm-hmm. It's changed, it's evolved over the years, but no, I don't think you have a Norman Lear. I don't think you have a Gene Roddenberry. I don't think you have what we accept as a showrunner today without mm-hmm. what he was doing in 1959.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's such a great observation. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great point. And it does make me think too of, the era in which he was writing for was a new era of television. And so I'm curious if you could speak to how he sort of created what we know, like you were saying, Joe, of television today. And as it took over radio, we didn't have a format for it. They didn't have a formula for TV yet. So I'm wondering, and you mentioned this in the book, Joe, his impact in this moment.
He's one of the handful of writers who was there at that moment in 1947, 1948, when, because the sets were expensive, not mm-hmm. everyone had them, it was a comparatively high class, high end, certainly when it comes to drama. Mm-hmm. I mean, Serling shares the stage with Horton Foote and Patty Chayefsky and Reginald Rose. Going back and looking at the Playhouse 90s and the earlier things he wrote, I decided I found a strong line of Clifford Odets mm. in his work, in that he was not afraid to go after big things mm-hmm. with a clear eye. He started in radio. Radio failed originally because they basically figured they could just get radio writers to do it. Mm-hmm. And that didn't work. They actually needed dramatists who knew how to move people around mm-hmm. on a limited stage. And Serling is one of, you can't talk about Serling's beginnings without talking about the fact that he was 18 years old when he enlisted in the Army in 1943 and left a very nice, comfortable suburban life in Binghamton, New York, and had an experience that 16 million other Americans had in the Second World War, and like a lot of them, they came back profoundly changed. Their aspect, their look at the world changed. And Serling had the heart of a writer, and he tried to write about it. And you can feel. I always like to think that there's an urgency in all of Rod Serling's mm-hmm. writing. That I have your attention now. There are some things I need to express. I'm going to try and get them to you entertainingly, but you have to pay attention. And yeah, maybe he was the first person in American television to stand there and say, you need to pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. I have some things to tell you. And that
I
was
love
really
that.
exciting.
Yeah.
It was really exciting to see that. I was a kid, but he had me. Fortunately, my parents were, you know, either indulgent or neglectful, but I got to stay up late on Friday nights and
Yeah.
see these things. And well, we, you know, we can get into it more in terms of how he accomplished what he accomplished. But the fact was, he wanted to say something, and he was a moralist, unapologetic. And he took a stand, and he wanted us to know this. I think this is right, and I think this is wrong. I think you need to think about this, and I think you need to think about that. It all comes into clearest focus in the Twilight Zone, but you can. I've never read a Rod Serling script where you don't feel his desire to communicate with you as directly and as cleanly as he possibly can. He meant what he said.
You know, it's interesting you said that because, you know, talking about the transition into television, there was the effort on the part of networks and advertisers to sort of downgrade the quality of the medium. And I always felt that Rod Serling was someone who stood, you know, on the bridge against the hordes coming at him and defending the kingdom as best he could. And the students picked up on that. I mean, they said to me as they watched these episodes that he literally took the medium and he elevated it. He made it an equal art form to theater and the other media that we consider to be higher forms of art. He worked to break, this is literally a quote, he worked to break the image of television as not thought-provoking. And I would love to hear, you're both writers, I'd love to hear how you see that in the way he wrote, because they were telling me, you know, the students were saying, look, we watched this, and Rod Serling made entertainment media something to learn from. And one of the things they pointed out was he trusted his audience. He didn't spoon feed the audience. He didn't care if the viewer doesn't get it at first. He's going to get you to think, and maybe only after you talk about it with other people and you think about it, maybe then you start to think about the message. And part of that is connecting with other people in the way they interpreted a particular episode. But there was something in the way he related to the audience with respect and the belief that they would get it.
Well, I think that the great leap he made, not for himself, but for everybody else, is when you look at the censorship troubles he had with the latter Playhouse 90s and things like that. And he made a remark jokingly saying, you know, they censored my piece about the United States Senate. I couldn't talk about it. If I set it on Mars and put a bunch of robots in there, it probably would have been just as effective. And I think that and an affection for science fiction that he had since he was a kid allowed him to say, I think I can make this leap. And there's a fascinating and irritating interview with Mike Wallace that was done just before the Twilight Zone premiered, in which Mike Wallace basically says, oh, so you're not going to do anything serious in television anymore. And Serling, who at that point had already started producing that first season, he just lets it go. He says, no, I'm just going to kind of kid around and have a good time. And certainly I won't be taking on any issues. And the moment the Twilight Zone begins, you realize you're somewhere else. What I found in the couple of months since my book has come out and I've done some press, I haven't found anybody who doesn't remember the Twilight Zone. Even people who have never seen the Twilight Zone remember the Twilight Zone. And they all have such positive, and so many writers who just say, this was, oh, the clarity. I think that's the beauty of the half hour Twilight Zones. They had to be. They were 25 minutes long. George Clayton Johnson, one of the writers, said the secret of the Twilight Zone is that it's all third act. And that reached me when I was a kid, and it's always been something. Serling, for me as a writer, he's always been something to reach for.
Yeah,
he took it seriously. He expected us to take it seriously. He had a love for language that he imparted to his characters, which he imparted to his audience. We all, you know, you hear someone like Jack Klugman say, well, you got a Serling script, you just did it because it was going to be the best language you ever got. And yeah, he may have made television drama, except he certainly made science fiction television. acceptable. And by, as you say, never talking down. There's a quote for him. He said, "You may not like," I'm butchering it. It's basically, you know, "You may not like this. You may not like that. If it's good, I get the rewards. If it's bad, I get the brickbats, but I've never written down."
Yeah. And you can't miss that. The students who watched his episodes. Now, we did watch a lot. We watched about 24 episodes. So they got a healthy dose of the Twilight Zone. But and I wish I could have shown them another 24. And I absolutely agree with what you said. You know, when he went for one season to that hour-long format, it wasn't as successful. It was the half-hour episodes that really hit you, that really got you to think.
That's true. But I have to say, I have to put in my vote for one of the hours, and that's on Thursday we leave for home.
Oh, that's the one. Yeah, I was hoping.
Yeah, which I say that is in many ways the Twilight Zone, and it's certainly his best sustained writing in the hour format.
There are
a couple of other; they're fine, but
no, you're right.
Honestly, Thursday kind of makes the apology for the whole 19 hour episodes.
Yeah. And it's one that once you've seen it, you will never forget it.
Mm-hmm. No,
I'm glad you mentioned the format, hour long versus half hour, and also the sort of breakneck speed of writing for TV. I think it was in your book, Joe. The writer doesn't have enough time to second guess or rethink or overthink. I'm curious your takes on how the format and that speed, you know, writing so quickly for a short amount of time, half hour, impacted the quality.
I think it's, well, the quality never drooped, because he was always associated with really smart producers. And he was the kind of writer, basically, I don't think he's ever handed a script to a producer that was unfilmable. I think he always knew that. It is a curse and a blessing to write episodic television. And particularly on the schedule he was doing it, because, you know, it's pure Zen. There's very little theory when you're writing that quickly. You have to lean on your craft. I had a, you know, but just with the luck of the draw, my last big job on television was for one of the last shows that did 22 episodes in a season. And there's a dynamic of writing. Things are going into production every 7 days. The scripts are behind you. The scripts are in front of you. You do not overthink. You trust yourself. And sometimes you stumble. And sometimes you look back and say, my favorite phrase is, I look back sometimes and I say, I wasn't smart enough to write that then. How did that happen? Because you get out of your way. Writing that fast, you get out of your way. Mm. Unfortunately, when Rod Serling got out of his own way, it was remarkable. Even when he's quote heavy handed, unquote, he's completely 100% sincere. There's no kidding around. The guy is there.
Yeah.
There's no challenge. You know, challenge the narration at the beginning or the end. Yes. These are being given to us. These are being presented to us. And so you sit there and you pay attention.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because again, that's one of the things the students mentioned. They mentioned one of my absolutely favorite episodes as a teacher, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, because it does two things. Number one, for the students, it was, you know, no matter how messy it gets, no matter how painful the lesson of what people are going through in the episode, what the characters are going through, there's something still that's uplifting about it. There's something that gives us reason for hope. So he could be heavy, he could be dark, and he would still give us reason to be optimistic and promote some kind of change for the better, give us the hope that this isn't inevitable. But the other thing that was fascinating about it, and something that you know, 18-year-olds were picking up on, is that these things were written, you know, by the time these kids were born, it had been written 40 years, you know, before they were even born. And yet they found relevance to their lives. They found relevance to current events and current politics. I mean, tell me The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street isn't about the insidious effects of social media.
No. I mean, I noticed that when I was writing about it, is I never, I hadn't until I sat down. I noticed that I can't remember now. I think it's Tommy is the boy's name. That
Yeah.
Tommy's responsible is really quite responsible for the whole place going crazy. He's the one who introduces this little. Oh no, it's like this is the way it's always been in all the stories, and the adults kind of lean into it. And I realized possibly because those adults were ready to believe this kind of stuff going on, and and the. Claude Akins character, he is the voice of reason for the body of it, but he loses it at the end. And the only literal escape is Serling's final narration in the episode, where it says, "This is a thing that can happen, not just in the Twilight Zone. This is what you need to watch out for." It's not, and it's not moralistic.
No.
It's observational.
It's entertainment and the message. That's the other thing is that, he always he was very good at the surprise ending, at the twists, whether it was To Serve Man or Eye of the Beholder. I mean, the twists have sort of become so well known that they don't surprise us anymore. But at the time, and as a psychologist, I can tell you what this does is it focuses your attention on waiting for the twist, on trying to figure out what is he going to do to us at the end? What is he setting us up for? And as we're thinking about that, he's subtly feeding us this wonderful, responsible, think about your role in society, reflect on the good and bad in each of us message that we don't have time to really argue with. We don't react to it. It's not preachy. It's not talking down to us the way so many PSAs tend to be, the way so much moralizing, when it's obvious tends to be. He puts it in there under the surface as our attention is distracted by what's unfolding in the plot and with the characters that we have become so invested in. And that's
The word,
genius.
the word I kept coming back to when I was writing about it, parable. They are rendered down. They are distilled into
Yes.
something so basic. And I think this is an element of why it's still finding its audiences today. And I'm so glad that you've got an experience with younger students who do not have that awful black and white filter where they just shut off. It's
No.
old where because once you get past that barrier and realize, oh, actually there's a lot of truth going on in black and white that I'm not getting in color. Once you understand what's going on there and you lean into it, I mean, again, it's like everyone has their favorite episodes. I mean, it's and here's a man who wasn't really sure that he had done something lasting. I mean, he really didn't know. He was concerned that his writing was not for the ages. He managed, he said it himself often enough, and here we are 50 years after his death. And I'm sorry, we are not talking about a lot of 1959 dramatic television. I mean, unless you want to come back and do Highway Patrol next week, but that there's this there was something there, and it was pure Serling. He carried it on. He had less success with the Night Gallery, but that's not his fault. He was just tired, and he did not have creative control of the show. And you can feel the pain and the stress and the frustration in those
Although
latter.
this time of year, it's a good time to revisit The Messiah on Mott Street, which felt
Yes.
like one of the episodes where he just let himself go and do what he
Yes.
wanted to do and give
Messiah,
himself
yeah,
permission.
Messiah on Mott Street suffers because of the perhaps overlauding of Tim Riley's bar.
Oh, okay. Sure.
But yeah, because no, there are a couple, there are, if you write Messiah and Tim Riley's, again, they justify the series. There are a couple of others in there too, which are really nice. I like some of the short story adaptations, like Green Fingers, where he seems to be having much more fun. It's just the show's just not as well produced as Twilight Zone,
Well,
and it's
because he
frustrating.
wasn't really the showrunner, was he? He didn't have that
No,
creative.
he made that decision, and you can kind of understand the decision. But unfortunately, he made an assumption that six Emmys and his stature would mean someone would listen to him, and he found out no, they rewrote him. And it was a miserable experience for him. And, you know, he didn't deserve it. Oh, God, that's shocking. There's someone on television who didn't deserve their fate.
I wanted to talk a little bit about when you first encountered Serling's work, each of you. And Joe, you write about it, and you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, when you were 8 years old. And yeah, I myself as a kid also, and I, it's the interesting sort of thing. And you also mentioned this, Joe, in your book. I don't necessarily recall specific episodes. Some of them I do, but it was that time of our lives when, as you say in your book, Joe, we're just absorbing things, and not really knowing what they mean yet. But I, for me personally, it's as I've grown up, you know, I've realized those lessons are in me, and you know, with my dad as a fan as well, like that sort of growing up in that environment also. But Bill, I'd be curious when you first encountered either, you know, any part of Serling's work. Did you also grow up with it?
No, a little bit. I mean, what was interesting was somehow, somewhere, and you know, I thank you know UHF channels for bringing back old shows on Sunday mornings and late on Friday and Saturday nights. But I don't know why I always remember. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet stuck out when I was a little kid. I remember that one. There was the one, and I'm desperately trying to remember the title of the episode because it was something that stuck in my head for the longest time. And Joseph, you'll remember, and I'll feel so stupid.
Okay.
It's the one about the woman who keeps having the dream over and over again. She ends up in the morgue where the woman comes out of the morgue and says, "Room for one more." And then she.
Yeah, I think it's called 22.
It was something with room 22, and I could, which was the number of the morgue, but I couldn't remember the actual title of the episode. Those things I remember as a small child just haunting me. And when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, I was watching The Night Gallery, and there are, you know, episodes that, again, they were so powerful for me as a child, and I was so impressed with what Rod Serling had been doing compared to, you know, the other television that I was watching at the time. But it really,
what else in Light Night Gallery do you remember?
Oh, I remember. I can't remember. I know. Looked for the name of the episode and now I've forgotten it, but it's the one where the man is challenged to go into a haunted house and he's convinced that his bones are slowly dissolving and he's going to turn into a slug.
I don't remember the title, but yeah, it's Theodore Flicker wrote it, and it's Leslie Nielsen and Severin.
Yes.
Oh, and Fritz Weaver.
Fritz Weaver.
I think it's called like Matter of Courage or something like that.
Yeah. I think it's season two, and it was that stuck in my head. There were just little snippets over the years. And again, I was 8, 9 years old, but they were. It was that. It was watching Star Trek, the original series. These things had a profound effect, and got me to start thinking about, you know, what's underneath the surface of these shows. It's obviously there's more to it than just the plot and the dialogue. There are messages here, and that kind of influenced my approach to media that culminated in being here at Ithaca College, where the whole point of Ithaca College is, yes, let's be successful, let's make a lot of money in entertainment media, and at the same time, let's use these media to change the way people think and to get people to think. And again, Rod Serling left his imprint on the way we think about media here at Ithaca College, and you're right, throughout the industry. So
it's interesting. I mean, there's the flip side of what you're saying is that we know that as writers we have a responsibility to use the media to say the things we want to say. And what I found is the problem with most lowercase e entertainment is that the creators have not recognized that even though they haven't done anything with it, they're teaching.
Yes.
There are. Yeah. If you don't choose your message, the message is just going to kind of be a kind of wash of consumerism and a rather feel good approach to things. People learn. You may not teach them, but they're going to learn.
Yes. That's right. That is so right. And so I make that point when I teach even a class that's not related to Rod Serling. When I teach media industries, we talk about Gene Roddenberry, we talk about Norman Lear, we talk about representation, and we talk about the things that really changed the face of the industry that came from members of disadvantaged groups. You can't talk about television without talking about Lucille Ball and how much creative control did women have in the 1960s over any big entertainment media. But there's so much when you start paying attention. There's so much that goes on, not just what people are writing, but who's writing it and who's producing it. Those are lessons that are worth paying attention to as well. So, and I've always been
Yeah,
a big
I
fan of
mean,
credits, reading the credits. So I want to see who was involved in this act of creation.
it's interesting. I've become aware of the fact that there's like that Lucille Ball is starting to get a little bit more recognition for what she was as an executive at Desilu,
Yeah.
and her championship with Roddenberry and Star Trek initially, and putting money on the line for it.
And she championed Rod Serling as well. I'm not sure if we would have had the Twilight Zone without Lucille
That's
Ball.
right. The Twilight Zone's unofficial pilot was an episode of an anthology show that they presented. I think it wasn't part of their. Yeah, it was. I was. I think it was a Westinghouse playhouse or something. But it was. Yeah, instead of Rod Serling, it was introed and outroed by Desi Arnaz.
Yes.
But
Yes.
that was the first. That was the first kind of backdoor pilot. You're right.
And they brought, they had the respect of the studio executives at CBS to bring them in and say, look, you've got to give this guy a platform. He's got something really special to share. And getting that audience with network executives made a huge difference.
Yeah. It's, again, it's like there's so many places for the great moments in television could have been derailed
Yes.
by something. And just like, the winds were right that day, and you got the lights and the traffic, and the right people were in the right mood and the right room. It's the, so, you know, I'm, it, it's so hard. It's hard to make bad television when you think about it. Imagine how much more difficult it is to make something that's good.
Good
Yeah.
point. Yes.
That's great. I did not know that about the Lucille Ball connection. And it's funny because it's shaping up to be a great podcast for my parents, because if it wasn't The Twilight Zone, it was I Love Lucy with my mom watching it. So it's really funny. I think just how Serling sort of changed television and solidified it as an art form. Almost any TV writer after that owes a little bit to Serling. But I'm curious if either of you can see in his writing or know of who influenced Serling, of his perhaps not TV writers, but I'm curious if you see any playwrights in his writing that you can tell he's been inspired by, or even as a lover of language, I'm sure there's just literature at large. I'm curious, what do you
I
think?
think it might be literature at large, because here's the thing about Rod Serling. He was a teenager in Binghamton in the 30s and 40s. He received what was considered at the time a normal liberal arts education. He went to high school. He went to high school at a time when you read a lot of poetry, you read a lot of short stories. You read a lot of drama, I mean, he's always had an affection for teachers, and he had an affection for the one particular teacher
Oh, yeah.
who basically said, basically, this is wonderful. What a shame he has to go off to war. But you see, he will drop quotes from obscure poets, and there was, I mean, I'm one of the generations who remembers the big poetry anthology book that you went through. There would be a poet, and they were all, yes, okay, there's Longfellow, but there would be some other people in there who you'd never heard of. And Serling likes to quote them. He likes his Shakespeare as well. I think it was a kind of general hungry feeding of oh, who wrote On a Note of Glory?
Norman Corwin.
Norman Corwin, thank you. He was an admirer of Norman Corwin, and
Oh, I didn't
I
know
think the
that.
more old, yeah, I remember
No.
him. I somewhere him, yeah. There was something about what Corwin was doing, particularly On a Note of Triumph, which was a major piece he wrote just at the end of the Second World War. in terms of responsibility and citizenship. You hear it, and but I think he was like most people his age at that time. He was a sponge too. He was, you know, there was no television. There was only radio, and there was what you could read. And he's soaked it, soaked it up, loved it, loved language, played with language his entire life. I mean, the way Rod Serling structures his speech, if you ever see his early scripts, The Twilight Zone included, but the Playhouse 90s, they're very, very bare on the page. There's very little stage direction. There's very little texture. They're not sales tools. They are construction plans. They're blueprints. And instead of saying things like, you know, a character should pause here, he would build in these little, he usually liked to repeat first names. He would repeat names to build in pauses. And the writers and the actors would recognize him. And you know, my favorite one is a Burgess Meredith one. Instead of saying, I don't know if I want to be alive, he says, think of it is, I don't know if I'm happy to be alive. He builds these little ramps. And again, it's like the other thing is what you were saying, basically, is I think you can, the two guiding lights of the Twilight Zone and arguably his entire body of work is that there are two points that we navigate between second chances and retribution, comeuppance. Characters are either deserving of a second chance or deserving of a comeuppance. And the phrase I like to say is, in the Twilight Zone, you may not get what you want, but you're always going to get what you've been asking for.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned the second chance and comeuppance, because that reading your book, you know, that's a through line. And we've kind of talked about his sense of morality in getting that. Are there any sort of other themes you can suss out from his catalog of work that you can kind of draw a line, you know, even through like Twilight Zone to Night Gallery or before the Playhouse 91s? Is there, you know, other than the comeuppance and chance?
Well, this is maybe a psychological too. He seems very concerned about the loss of identity.
Yes.
And how you can convince people that you are who you say you are. People are, a lot of characters lose their identity. And it's, if you want to speak to that, I'd love to hear that aspect of it.
You know, we talked about that a lot. Yeah, The Shelter was like that. The Monster, he was a brilliant social psychologist. I mean, my background isn't in writing and literature. My degree is in social psychology. And I use episodes of The Twilight Zone to illustrate principles of social psychology, of group influences, of social influence. And, you know, and then sometimes you're right, losing identity. If you remember the episode, I Am the Night, Color Me Black, was that the, the title right? I mean, where literally everything is plunged into darkness, because the idea of losing your identity and that becoming a way of facilitating horrible behavior, you know, lynch mobs, typically lynchings usually take place at night because people can be anonymous, and again, he prefigures so much of the horror of the internet, where people by being disconnected from their identities can do and say horrible things to each other. He was warning us about that, you know, 65 years ago. And that's, you know, again, the students understand that. And that's the beauty of it, is his messages were so, you know, technology changes, television, you know, gets fancier. And you're right, it's color now and the special effects are better. But the students don't care, because these 18-year-olds are looking at it and they understand he's addressing basic human psychology, and our brains don't evolve as quickly as technology. The same problems we had with each other in 1959 and 1960, these students are still wrestling with. And if anything, looking at it in black and white and looking at it happening either in a science fiction setting or some idyllic town from the, you know, 1950s, it creates it creates almost a it's like a projective test. It's like a mirror. I mean, I think it's not coincidental that a show that was very much influenced by The Twilight Zone, The Black Mirror, has mirror in the title, because literally he held up, well, not literally, literally figuratively, Rod Serling held up a mirror to us. And because it was a little bit bare bones, and because it's black and white, students can look into that mirror and they see themselves. And they said this, every one of them gets something a little bit different from an episode of The Twilight Zone. And every one of them gets something meaningful from an episode of The Twilight Zone because it relates to them. And maybe because it isn't encased in tremendous special effects and great camera work, maybe because it's so bare bones, they have the opportunity to see themselves.
What you're saying is astonishingly reassuring to me
Yeah.
that this is actually the experience you're having with 18-year-olds right now.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm going to tell you something else that I just, because I want to make sure we have time for it. Watching The Twilight Zone, they discovered that television is meant to be consumed with other people. These are kids who are used to streaming, on their phones. They're watching, alone in their dorm rooms, and they realize television is meant to be something that you share, because as you watch it together, it becomes a way of sharing what you thought. It's almost a it's a stress-free, unthreatening way, because you're not talking about yourself. You're talking more about your reactions to this episode that you're watching together. And you can it's they literally use the word safe space. It's a safe space to say what you're thinking. And because it's acceptable to interpret it in different ways, it's acceptable to listen to the other person. It makes you less judgmental and less opinionated when you have this shared media experience. So they really loved watching The Twilight Zone because they used it to connect with each other.
This is spectacular good news to this lonely writer over here.
Yeah, that is great to hear. And it made me think too of another question. Because you mentioned streaming, I'm curious. What do you think? What's the sort of work Serling would be creating nowadays if he were still around? Do you think? Of course he'd be 100, so maybe not that active. But say he was, in his most active writing in this day and age. What do you think he'd be on this, TV for the streaming services, or, I don't. I'm curious about what you both think about that.
I don't know. He was so becoming a great teacher when he passed away. I think, and if you there's a if you ever if you want to read a fantastic book about Rod Serling, you should read his daughter's book, How As I Knew Him.
Yes.
It's just an astonishingly beautiful book. I think he would have focused on his teaching more. And he had been the angry young man. He says it was it. He said television was a rough job for anybody over 40. He might have become just the greatest teacher of media. Perhaps he still is. Let me put it to you
He
that way.
still
I
is.
don't know. Yeah, he still is. It's funny. It's hard for me to think about what he would have written fictionally, but it's very easy for me to imagine him as a teacher.
Oh yeah. And I wish he were still here. And you can see how much he venerated teachers. Do you remember the episode? It was the end of season three, The Changing of the Guard.
No, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And the students were just so struck by that, so moved by that.
Did they? Because it's not an unexpected episode. It kind of unfolds the way it unfolds. But so their reactions were, how did they react to it? And again, there's a man spouting ancient poetry. There, before you go, says there is nothing more disturbing than to hear Professor Fowler describe himself as a failure. And I have this terrible feeling that these are ghosts that haunted Rod Serling.
Of course. Of course. And
But
I
no,
mean, all of
what
them
is it?
died in
What?
war. If you noticed, almost all of them died saving other people during war. They were struck by the beauty of it, and the idea that you can have that everything you do has the potential to make a profound difference in someone's life, and you wouldn't know it. And that's what I think really, you know, that the things we say to each other and the little things we do to each other that we don't even notice or that we think were entirely unmet by a receptive audience, that we think we failed, that we didn't get through to people around us, and we did. And it gave them a sense, first of all, it gave them a sense of humility that you know, the things we say to each other matter. That the things we say to each other make a difference, and you can, for good or for bad. I mean, that was another message that ran throughout the Twilight Zone, is the things that we say to, and do, even those little things, make such a difference in people's lives. And I think that humbled them. And it made them realize that the experience of being in the classroom or the experience of, you know, the way they interact as students, as peers, they have a tremendous power to make a difference in someone's life. Again, to lift them up, or to crush them with just a few words.
Boy, I have to tell you, just listening to you describe what's been going on in your classrooms, it's, I don't want to put a lot on your shoulders, but you're actually, this is one of the first times in a long time I felt rather positive about the world and life. The fact that this is still going on, that these things are finding this kind of reception. Yeah. God, gosh darn, and I just wish Rod knew this stuff.
Well, I can do the next best thing. I can let his daughter know. His daughter's in the area, and she's friends with one of my colleagues, Nick Sagan. So I'll pass this along to her. I wanted to do that.
Do you know Anne? I've spoken to Anne a couple of times. I just think she's a remarkable writer and a remarkable human being. Yeah. So please say hello. And I've talked to her close, so please say hello for me.
I would love to meet her. I'm going to use Nick Sagan as a go-between for now, because I don't know Anne, but he does. And I do want her to know that. I want her to realize her father's still alive.
We're discussing one writer and one writer's experience and the impact that this one man had. That continues, you know, and to affect people who do not know they're being affected by it.
That's right.
It's a tremendous gift. You do the best you can. And if, I mean, as I used to like throwaway line sometimes, is basically as you show up and you do the work, you the best way you know how to do it, and immortality takes care of itself. it's not your job. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But this is, I'm serious. This is very reassuring. That there are kids at this age group who are able to respond to this stuff again. I'm getting a little weepy over here.
Good. It is good to hear. And you know, we talked about Twilight Zone and Night Gathering, a little bit of Playhouse 90, and real quick, are you know some of the teleplays that he did before Twilight Zone, the ones that kind of launched his career in a way. One for me that I really love is Requiem for a Heavyweight. I watched that in a course at Ithaca, actually. It stuck with me since then. Talking about identity and the way your identity can be controlled by others without you even knowing it sometimes. But then, you know, Mountain, you know, eventually takes control of his own life and chooses to follow his own bliss, like Joseph Campbell, as you mentioned, Joe, in the book as well. I watched that movie along with reading Joseph Campbell's work, so it was very worked very well. So if you could each speak a little bit about those early ones, Patterns, and I'm getting the other one.
Patterns is the one that landed him for what it was, if he'd only written Requiem, I think we'd still be talking about him because of, as you said, basically it's about a man who, you know, for the first 7 minutes of the play, he's unconscious.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And people talk around him and talk over him. And then when he wakes up, he's told he doesn't have a job anymore. And what's he supposed to do? And what I like, when I was looking at Requiem again, it's a prize fighter who's been told he can't fight anymore. Arguably, that sounds like a very cliched statement, but one of the great things about Searing is that he was willing to take what looked like cliched setups and situations and characters, and instead of And running with the assumptions and then playing against them after you thought you knew what you were going to get. I mean, that's the, you know, the remarkable thing about Requiem is, as you say, this is a very slow guy. What I said when I last looked at it, I said, he's a character in Serling who has thoughts, but it takes him a long time to be able to say anything. The process of thought is difficult for Mountain, and that's been his disadvantage. But in the end, he does make a decision. People encourage him, but he finally makes his own mind up, helped by the girl. If you looked at it schematically, it's a very cliched piece. But the performances and the writing, this is another thing I believe, there are no cliches. There are cliched approaches to situations. Familiarity doesn't breed contempt. Familiarity breeds access. You think you know where you're going in the Twilight Zone. You think you know where you're going with Patterns or Requiem. But there's a richness in the pieces that surprise you. There's a richness in Rod Serling's writing that surprises you when you come along. And just to cite something now that was gone for a long time, and may not be the best thing he's ever written, but it's probably the angriest thing he's ever written, and that's Carol for Another Christmas, which he wrote in 1964, which is just, again, something else which has picked up.
Right.
Yeah, which is something else which has picked up relevance over the past 60 years and is now just scary with some of the connective tissue that he's offering in the piece.
Yeah.
But Requiem deserves all the praise that it gets.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. As we're getting close to the end here, was there anything about Serling or his impact on your life and careers that we haven't covered that you wanted to touch base on?
I just said I'd say I wouldn't have a career without.
Yeah.
If I hadn't seen it, if I hadn't fallen under that spell, and realized that this was something you could do, and this is something you should do with your writing. My joke is basically I do have an Emmy and I won it in the category he won his 6 Emmys in.
Mm-hmm.
That means an awful lot to me. The fact that it was the same category means a lot more than the award itself. It was a Joseph Campbell moment. It was a bliss moment, basically. This is the thing that they gave him and I got it. And I said, okay, now I'm on the job here.
That's great. Yeah.
I have to go back to what Joseph said, insightful as everything that you've said. I learned so much from you, so thank you for that. But you're absolutely right. What I learned from Rod Serling was how to be a better teacher, because he was throughout his episodes. I mean, you know, it, I don't know why, but sometimes the things we see every day don't sink in. I realized only a couple of days ago that there's a display case in the hallway on the second floor of the Park School of Communication that contains 5 of his Emmys, the actual statuettes. My classroom is literally on the other side of that wall. And I never made the connection, but it was almost as if it was meant to be. And when I see the way he teaches us about people and the things we can give and do for each other, and the way listening to each other, I mean, you know, I haven't shown the students Requiem just because we have time constraints in class, but I did show them The Big Tall Wish, and we talked about the meaning of magic and what was the magic he was talking about. And just like so much else, it comes down to our relationship with each other and that beautiful relationship he had. What made him who he was wasn't whether or not he won in the ring. It was the relationship he had with that little boy and the way he changed his life. And as a teacher, I look at that and I think, you know, gosh, maybe I don't have a lot of publications. Maybe I'm, you know, sort of just an old punch drunk academic on the downside of a career. But as long as I have those connections with these kids, I'm blessed. That is the magic. It truly is.
Yeah, well said. Well said. And thank you both again for joining me. A great way to
this has been great. This has been a wonderful hour.
Yeah,
I appreciate it greatly, gentlemen.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and have a great rest of your holiday season.
Thank you. Thank you so much for hosting us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.